Was I gay, bi, pan, or some other label that I had never heard of? I tried on the different labels as if they were shirts, but nothing seemed to fit right. I thought that I needed a label to be legitimate.
I wrote God's Own Country on spec, and I just wanted to show the world a little bit of how I see my world.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucy Chappell. Beijing court considers China's LGBT cyber chokehold, the genesis and exodus of the word queer, and a behind-the-camera look at God's Own Country. All that and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the 3 weeks ending January 6th, 2018. A court in Beijing has agreed to hear a challenge to the ban on queer content in online media issued in mid-2017 by China's State Administration of Press, Publication, Radio, Film, and Television. The agency issued the directive last June, restricting internet providers from streaming TV shows and films that depict what it called abnormal sexual lifestyles or behavior. Same-gender sexual attraction is lumped into 84 specifically banned subjects that include luxurious lifestyles, superstition, sexual assault, and incest. Regulators banned abnormal sexual relationships and sexual behavior from motion pictures and broadcast and cable television shows in 2015. According to Pink News, the June 2017 online ban led to 291 video streaming platforms being shut down and almost 10,000 journalists losing their jobs. The lawsuit was filed on January 3rd by 30-year-old Fan Chunlin after the regulator refused to respond to his public information request asking why it deemed homosexuality to be abnormal. While LGBT activists are not optimistic about a favorable ruling, expected in August, they say the case will raise awareness of LGBT people and that the agency will at least be forced to provide a legal rationale for the ban. China's seemingly schizophrenic bureaucracy decriminalized private consensual adult homosexual acts in 1997 and officially removed homosexuality from a list of mental illnesses in 2001.
The Taipei High Administrative Court rejected a lesbian couple's marriage equality bid on January 4th after a city agency refused to register their union. They're the third Taiwanese lesbian couple seeking recognition to be rejected by the court since October. It ruled this week that household registration offices have no legal authority to register the union of same-gender couples and pointed to the landmark decision by the island's Constitutional Court in May 2017, giving legislators 2 years to equalize marriage laws. This week's plaintiffs were among 30 lesbian and gay couples who applied to city offices in August 2014 for legal recognition of their unions. All were turned away, and three of the lesbian couples subsequently filed lawsuits. The Taiwan Alliance to Promote Civil Partnership Rights, which helped the couples file the lawsuits, issued a media statement lamenting the court's decision, but in also citing the Constitutional Court ruling, said it's now the responsibility of the government to get a marriage equality bill enacted.
The lawyer for a gay Singaporean doctor announced on January 5th that his client plans to appeal a court's rejection of his bid to adopt his biological child, who was born through a surrogate mother in the United States. The court refused to allow the adoption last month, ruling that the birth of his baby through a surrogate would not have been legal in socially conservative Singapore. The prospective parent's name has been withheld because the case involves a minor. The doctor's attorney, Ivan Chong, told reporters that the family division of the High Court in Singapore would hear the appeal, but that a date has yet to be set.
All eyes in Bermuda continue to be focused on Governor John Rankin, the Queen's legal representative in the British Overseas Territory. Lawmakers on the Caribbean island passed a bill in mid-December that overturned the marriage equality ruling issued by the nation's High Court in May and created less-than-equal domestic partnerships for same-gender couples instead. But what is usually a routine royal assent has yet to be issued, and there does not appear to be a formal time frame for it. Rankin has been described as being between a rock and a hard place because marriage equality has been the law of the land in Britain and many of its other territories for a number of years. A spokesperson confirmed this week that the governor is continuing to consider the measure and is taking legal advice as appropriate. It's not that unusual for the governor to seek advice from the UK Foreign Office about the compatibility of a bill with international obligations. The governor is required to ensure that legislation is consistent with the UK's obligations towards any other state or power or any international organization.
The Irish News reported in late December that a marriage equality lawsuit is headed to Northern Ireland's Court of Appeals. Echoing the same idea advanced in other countries, that it is up to lawmakers and not the courts to create marriage equality, Mr. Justice O'Hara ruled in August that the European Union leaves it up to member states to decide the issue. The lesbian and gay plaintiff couples, Grain Close and Shannon Sickles, and Chris and Henry Flanagan Kane, respectively, were among the first to register their civil partnerships when they became legal in Northern Ireland 12 years ago. Both couples are now parents. Each said they believe civil partnerships would be just a first step and that they'd soon be converted to marriage. One of their attorneys said the couples have always been in it for the long haul, but that no one was expecting it to be quite this long. The prominent human rights firm, KRW Law, which is representing the couples pro bono, argues that marriage equality falls under Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which guarantees the right to a personal and family life. Demands for marriage equality continue to grow elsewhere. Lawsuits have been filed in recent weeks by queer couples in Namibia and Bulgaria.
A federal court ordered the Pentagon to open service to qualified transgender personnel no later than January 1st, despite President Trump's opposition. And yet another and still pending study of the issue being conducted by Defense Secretary James Mattis. Barack Obama's Defense Department thoroughly studied the issue and concluded in 2016 that opening military service to transgender people would not create an undue burden on the armed forces. It's anyone's guess what study conclusions Secretary Mattis will announce, apparently sometime next month, or what the fate of currently serving transgender troops will be. But lawsuits challenging the proposed ban are still active in a number of federal courts.
Donald Trump has suddenly fired all remaining members of his Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. A half dozen members had already resigned in 2017 to protest what they perceived to be the administration's disinterest in dealing with the disease. The remaining 16 were unceremoniously terminated 2 days before Christmas via a FedEx-delivered letter. No reason was given, and most council members expressed shock at the unexpected terminations. One of them, Gabriel Maldonado, executive director of the LGBT HIV group True Evolution, speculated during a conversation with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow this week as to why the entire Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS now has 22 empty chairs.
Like any council, we have differences of opinions. We have different ways of approaching public health and how we see HIV and AIDS policy. I would definitely say that many of us were contributing authors of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, which strongly supported and was included with the Affordable Care Act. And many of us on the council had fundamental differences from the direction that this administration seems to have taken.
No replacements for the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS have been named.
Two fans who were arrested in Egypt in September for waving a rainbow flag at a Cairo concert by the progressive Lebanese rock group Mashru Leila, which is fronted by an openly gay man, have been released on bail. 28-year-old Sarah Hegazi and 21-year-old Ahmed Allah each paid 2,000 Egyptian pounds, about $113, according to a lawyer from the Arabic Network for Human Rights. It's not clear when their trial will be held. The small group of rainbow flag wavers were extensively covered and condemned by several media outlets. The government then launched its latest crackdown on LGBT people and institutions. Arrests for debauchery or sexual deviancy in the last few months of 2017 skyrocketed.
An Egyptian parliamentary commission on religion announced plans in late December to push legislation to make promotion of atheism a crime. The commission has concluded that atheism can cause mental imbalances that lead to same-gender attraction. The plan follows a second proposal to criminalize private consensual adult homosexual acts, which are not specifically against the law in Egypt. The bill calls for prison sentences of from 1 to 3 years. Critics have condemned it as the most homophobic proposal in the world because it could even jail someone for simply being in possession of a rainbow flag.
But finally, the late Sally Ride made history as the first, closeted because she had to be, American woman in space. The U.S. Postal Service unveiled a stamp in her honor in mid-December, in addition to stamps commemorating, among others, John Lennon and children's television pioneer Mr. Rogers. Sally Ride died in 2012 from pancreatic cancer after devoting her life to promoting education and space exploration. She posthumously came out and publicly acknowledged her surviving long-term partner in the obituary she authorized. Her portrait will join Harvey Milk's as out LGBT trailblazers to grace forever first-class U.S. postage stamps later this year. You remember postage stamps, don't you?
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the 3 weeks ending January 6, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
It was incredible to work on this film. I mean, all the process that we had and all the things that we had to do and working on farms, and this is the way I want to work and this is the way I love to work.
Find out all that went into an international festival hit to make what comes out on screen so powerful later in the program. Screw the labels. Words we use to describe ourselves are changing as fast as our rapidly changing world. And one of Outkasting's young commentators finds good reasons to screw the labels, or use them, or both.
This is Outkasting Overtime, a special feature from Outkasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Lucas, a youth participant in Outkasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Lauren talks about her experiences with labels. Labels can be helpful for some and limiting for others. Lauren, like many LGBTQ youth, had difficulty with labels when she was first coming to terms with her sexuality.
When I was 12 years old, I had a crush on a girl. I'd never liked a girl until then, and I did not know how to handle it. Some people come out immediately after they realize that they like people of their own gender. A woman might realize that she has fallen in love with another woman, everything will click into place at once, and she will come out as a lesbian the next day. But for most people, it's a slower process, especially when you're in middle school. I was lucky enough to know that there were words for girls who liked other girls, and I was lucky enough to know that I wasn't the only one. But things didn't make sense immediately. I didn't know whether I was one of those girls, or if this was just a one-time thing. I didn't know whether I still liked guys either. All I knew was that I liked girls, or one girl, meaning that I was not straight. So I started to come out to friends as not straight. But it turns out it is quite difficult to come out as not something. People want to know more than that. Was I gay, bi, pan, or some other label that I had never heard of? I tried on the different labels as if they were shirts, but nothing seemed to fit right. I made scales in my head. Counted up crushes I'd had on girls and crushes I'd had on boys. I tried to place myself on the Kinsey scale or as a percentage, as if you could really be 75% gay. I felt like I needed a label. There had been a few times that I had told people that I liked a girl, and they thought that I was just joking or I just thought that she was pretty. I thought that I needed a label to be legitimate. A year or two later, I stumbled upon the word queer online. The general definition of it that I found was not straight. But if you called yourself queer, you were no longer speaking in negatives. People from across the LGBTQ spectrum called themselves queer, and people like me, who were trying to figure out who they were but couldn't put a word on it yet, called themselves queer. If labels were shirts, queer was a big, comfortable one. I started to call myself queer. The first reaction that I got from this was negative. I had come out to an older person in my life who asked me, "Why would you ever call yourself that?" I felt ashamed, like maybe I was hurting people without knowing that I was. So I did what I enjoy doing most. I researched. Queer is actually a really interesting word. There are a few theories about where the word comes from, but one theory is that it comes from a Proto-Indo-European root that I can't even pronounce, T-E-R-K-W. It means to twist, turn, wind, or cut. So it could be said that queer meant not straight before straight meant heterosexual. The word went through a few linguistic changes before eventually becoming the Scottish word queer. It gained the meaning of different, although it usually meant different in a bad or strange way. Around the beginning of the 20th century, it began to mean homosexual, and by the mid-20th century, it solidified its definition as homosexual in a derogatory way. So, when did things change? In the 1980s, the activist group Queer Nation emerged. The group hoped to be shocking. They believed that it was necessary at that point in time. They also wanted to reclaim the word queer, to take it back from the people who had used it against them. The slogan, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it," became popular, and queer studies became an academic field. Older LGBT people often have negative feelings towards the word, as it was used frequently to bully them in their youth. But for me and many young people, this experience was not shared. The first time that I heard the word queer, it was from the LGBT community, while I mostly heard gay used as an insult growing up. That doesn't mean that the word carries no historical weight. Everything does, and it is understandable that it causes pain to some people. But it can be helpful, too. My current feeling about it is this. I can use it to refer to myself, but not anyone else. I also started to refer to myself as bisexual, which has felt more comfortable as time has gone on. But another thing has changed, too. As I've grown up and become more confident, I felt less and less that I need a label. It is helpful to have, for coming out and for dating, but at this point it doesn't feel as important as it used to. I will use one label for months, I will switch among three in the same conversation, I will tire of words completely and just kind of exist. A label can change what people see, but for me, it no longer has the power to change what's on the inside.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producers are Alex Mintz and Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Follow your favorite international LGBT radio show on Twitter at TWO Radio, read our blog at twopodcast.blogspot.com, and check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. There are also links to all three at thiswayout.org. Is God's Own Country England's Brokeback Mountain? Entertainment correspondent Steve Pride weighs that question with its creator and co-star.
God's Own Country is a stunning gay love story of both brutality and tenderness, set in the rustic hills of West Yorkshire in the UK.
I'm Francis Lee, and I am the writer and director of God's Own Country.
My name is Alex Acarano, and I'm an actor. I'm one of the two leads in God's Own Country.
God's Own Country is primarily about Johnny Saxby, who is a Yorkshire sheep farmer, and he is running the farm on his own because his father's had a stroke and his grandma's quite old. All his friends have moved away to university or college or got jobs in towns, so he's very isolated, very lonely. He's shut down emotionally to be able to continue the work and keep the farm going. It comes to spring, and all the sheep are going to give birth to their lambs, and he can't do it on his own, so his father employs a Romanian migrant worker who's in the UK looking for work to come and help him, and it becomes about their relationship.
What inspired this?
The starting point for the film was the landscape, really. So I grew up on the hills in Yorkshire. I left when I was 20. I escaped to London to train as an actor. But I could never get that landscape out of my head. It felt to have totally informed who I was emotionally and physically. And so when I was thinking about stopping acting and making film, it just felt like a place that I had to investigate, that I had to explore, and also to represent those people that I knew so well from that area. I've only been making film for about 5 years. I got to a certain point in my career as an actor where I was very dissatisfied. I'd fallen out of love with it years before. I wasn't doing work that I felt was challenging. I always wanted to tell stories, and I had always seen the world visually. I'd been an obsessive stills photographer, but I'd never been confident enough to actually say that or to sit down and write anything. And I got to a certain age and thought, I'm going to have to do something. So I gave up acting. I got a job in a junkyard and started to write. And I wrote 3 short films and self-financed those by the job in the junkyard. And while I was doing that, I had this idea. I was exploring this idea of landscape, as I said, and the people who live on this hillside that I know so well. And so I wrote God's Own Country on spec. I just sat down and wrote it. And I just wanted to show the world a little bit of how I see my world.
Alec, when you first read the script, what connected with you?
I think it was one of the most detailed scripts that I've ever read. Every single glimpse and every single gesture that you can see in the film, it was written in the script. That made me really connect with the characters and with the story, and it's a very beautiful and powerful story. Of course, after I read the script, I really wanted to meet Francis, and I got a chance when he came to Bucharest to audition to see 14 or 13 Romanian actors. And we worked together for half an hour or 45 minutes, and I really understood that he knew what he wants from this story and from this film.
How did you prepare them for what was not just acting, but some very difficult and specific farm work?
I worked with both Josh and Alec, who played the leads in the film, for about 3 months before the shoot. And we worked primarily on the characters in that period. We started from the moment they were born until the moment we meet them in the film. And we worked through everything, not just on a timeline, but also in terms of relationships, family relationships, friends. Every single little detail about these men we discovered and we learnt and we worked on. Right down to if they had sugar in their tea, what socks they preferred, everything. So by the time we got to the actual shoot and Alec and Josh came to the set, they were totally immersed in their characters. So then for 2 weeks before we started the shoot, I sent them to work on farms because I knew I never wanted a stunt double or a hand double. I never wanted to be pulled out of this film with fakery. So both actors went and worked on 2 separate farms, and they worked long, solid shifts. And they would start early in the morning and they would end their shift late at night, and they learnt to do everything. They learnt how to birth lambs. They learnt how to build walls. I mean, they literally learnt everything. It was really important to me that they embodied these characters both physically and emotionally. And there's such a impact that working that way has on somebody physically. They got cold, they got wet, they got miserable, and these were all great things for me because that's what the characters were going through. So again, by the time it came to shooting the scenes when they had to do the farm stuff, both of them were totally proficient, as if they'd been doing it their whole entire lives.
You shot this chronologically too. Explain why.
The script very much felt like each scene acted like building blocks in this relationship. I love actors, and I will do anything I can to support them, to get the very best out of them, and to facilitate their work. And so it felt really important to me that if I could shoot chronologically, that would really help the development of their relationship. It also added this extra benefit The way in which the film is structured, Alec's character, Gyorgy, isn't there at the beginning of the film. So I could keep them apart. And as people, Josh and Alec wouldn't get to know each other very well. So they wouldn't have developed that comfortable kind of relationship. And for me, that was going to translate on screen. So the first time they meet on screen, not completely, but it was almost the first time they kind of had worked together. So there was that extra layer of kind of tension or nervousness that I thought would just add a little bit of extra something in the scene. Once the relationship between the two boys develops, I move them both into the same house, and they built this beautiful, lovely, caring friendship between them. And again, that translated onto screen. So anything I could do to enable that, to make it feel richer and deeper, I did.
Alec, as an actor, did filming in this way make it easier or more difficult?
No, it's a lot easier. I mean, you can't find this kind of work with many directors. And it was incredible to work on this film. I mean, all the process that we had and all the things that we had to do and working on farms and developing our characters from scratch and discussing about them and knowing their lives from the point they were born until we see them on screen. And this is the way I want to work, and this is the way I love to work. And Francis did an amazing job in creating this environment and letting these things happen.
At one point in the film, you put your arm inside a cow, and later you birth a sheep.
Yeah.
At least now, though, you have something to fall back on if this acting thing doesn't work out.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Alec will be fine in the acting world. I'm hoping, and I know, he isn't going to need anything to fall back on.
God's Own Country is being called the UK Brokeback Mountain.
I'm really super flattered by the Brokeback comparisons. I think it's a masterpiece in storytelling, and Ang Lee is an incredible storyteller. And those are phenomenal performances at the heart of it. I think this film is different. Brokeback is about sexuality. It's about society's attitude towards sexuality at that very specific time. Whereas I do think this film is more about love and about the human condition, which feels slightly more universal, maybe.
This has been a conversation with writer-director Francis Lee and actor Alec Saccarano about their film, God's Own Country. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and John Dyer V, produced by Steve Pride, Outcasters Lucas and Lauren, produced by Mark Sophos and Steve Pride. Rachel Platten and Patrick Wolf performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. You can continue the groundswell of year-end support at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KMUD, Redway in Garberville, California, to CCC Gosford, New South Wales, CJLY Nelson, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.